A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.
Welcome to the Shogun Podcast, where the Lorehounds, your guides to the political intrigues of feudal Japan. I'm David.
And I'm John. This is our coverage for episode 4, titled The Eightfold Fence, of the FX limited series Shogun, now streaming on Hulu.
We're going to be covering this episode by major character arcs, talking about our favorite moments, and then answering a little bit of a listener feedback.
We have set up an email, so if you have feedback or questions, send those to shogun@thelorehounds.com or head to the contact page on our website and use the form or record us a voicemail that we can drop right into the podcast.
Also join us on our Discord. We've got a fun and active community with a great mod team, and we've got a whole bunch of special channels set up for general conversation and then episode specific conversation.
If you're interested in supporting the Lorehounds community, check us out on Patreon or Supercast. Supercast is basically just Patreon, but built for podcasters especially. There's also a subscriber and community-built online character guide we're calling the show's Rudder.
Yes.
That, David, Rutter. You are spearheading, and we've got all the Dunedain contributing and some community members submitting things too. So it's just, you know, it's got a character guide. It's got details on the episodes, the world building. It's a lot of fun. That's exclusive to Patreon or Supercast subscribers. And I think we'll talk more about that at the end.
Yes. And at the end, we'll also talk a little bit about how you can support the community if you are so inclined, as well as a little bit about our upcoming podcast schedule. So that's at the end of the podcast. And then, of course, at the end of this, well, I was trying to do an end around joke, but it's not really working out. Just go to the show notes and all the links for all the things are there. So check that out.
Cool.
Yeah.
David, I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks. This is you were down.
I'm back
with the Blackthorn plague.
Yes. I'm John Blackthorn. I am back, and I appreciate Alicia sitting in for me, and I hope everybody had a good time. I've been having a good time with Shogun. It's been a really cool ride. It's some cool ass television. I'm very happy with it.
It's my favorite show of the year so far. I'm hot on this.
Yeah. It's got all the political intrigue. It's got all the character. It's doing it all.
I live for it.
It's like a perfect Lorehounds show, right? It's got history and it's got character. It's got intrigue. It's got beautiful sets and sceneries. Yeah. It's a pretty much right in our zone.
Absolutely. So what'd you think of the episode in general?
This episode I really enjoyed. It was very light on its feet until it wasn't. And when it wasn't, it didn't,
yeah.
You know, it was supposed to be exactly where it was. I'm really impressed at the construction of this season overall so far. When it's, I guess the last episode with the, there's a couple of points where I was like, oh, it's a little kind of weird. But so far, in terms of four episodes, all the episodes are the right puzzle pieces for the story so that we feel like we're really moving along. At the same time, we're getting to know our characters and being able to spend time with them. You know, it's a very common thing to complain about pacing in television. And so not to get mired into that conversation, but just to say that this season so far, the pacing has been really nice. There's action when you need action. There's downtime when you need downtime. There's so much humor in this show. And at the same time, it's such a deadly serious situation, but it never feels the show. Remember the first season of House of the Dragon? It was heavy. It was so good, right? I loved that season, but it was just, there was no humor. There was no levity in it. And I think that's something that this season is showing us, is that if you just sprinkle a little bit of it here and there, it just really lightens the whole show, so we can get through the hard parts when we need to.
Yeah, I completely agree about that. I mean, I was a little suspicious, I guess, of the Blackthorn shtick at first, but it really working. Grew on me to the point where he's charming me. Maybe I'll go on an imaginary date with him.
I was same as you. I was really, well, I wasn't so much worried about the Blackthorn shtick, but I was worried about the actor being able to play this role. And he's got this kind of puppy dog-ish quality about him, and this sort of slightly bumbling quality about him. And it's kind of weirdly charming. It's actually working on me.
So, and I really buy the parts where he's, you know, speaking in a tone that seems like it's respectful, but saying like, go fuck your mother's ankles or whatever, you know, whatever he's saying. He's really just laying on every insult he can to people he doesn't like, but in a language they don't understand.
Yeah.
And I'll get to it later, but my God, is Mariko a charitable translator?
Yes, very much so. I wanted to shout out to Tadanobu Asano. I know I've got the syllables all wrong on that, but the actor who's playing Yabashuge-sama. Sorry, I'm a little bit out of the podcasting game, so my mouth is still warming up to the syllables here. But God, I love watching this guy on screen. He is so funny, and he is so serious, and he's so earnest, and he's so deadly, and he's so psychopathic, and he's just everything. And every time he's on screen, I'm just eating it up. And the acting across the board is just incredible. The actor who's playing Fuji-sama, she blew me away this episode. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have been really impressed with her character development this particular episode. It was so good. And a couple of my favorite scenes when we get to that section are around Fuji-sama. The funny thing... Go ahead.
Can I just add that, you know, I've often said I don't want I don't want extreme violence, and I don't want sexual... you know, extreme sexual stuff, unless it means something.
Unless it serves the story. Yeah.
And Fuji-sama, or is it San? I don't know. I don't know what I'm supposed to call her in this. I think it might be San.
We need Abby.
She's from a lower rank, I think.
Yeah. Okay. But I know, I think San and Sama are different eras. I think in this particular era, they used Sama instead of San.
No, he's Anjin-san. He's not Anjin-sama.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We need some guidance from the community.
Anyway, I think San is basically Mr.
Okay.
It's like Sir. And then Sama is basically like Lord or Lady.
Interesting. All right.
So anyway, Fuji San Sama, whoever she is, she, you know, she has this horrific act done to her family in the first episode. And to me, I was like, why do we have to have the baby dying and her husband? But now I kind of understand where they were going with it. You know, this contrast with how Mariko deals with grief, this whole speech on the Eightfold Fence, and just this way that she sort of has this strength within her when it comes to Blackthorn.
Yeah.
And is very cautious about it, but also understands when she's getting a new ally. And it's wonderful. It's really wonderful. So you're right. The performance was amazing.
Yeah. Just some of the little looks that she had. I mean, just all the actors are really bringing their A games. And it's so lovely to see.
And she had such a thoughtful gift of a courtesan.
we'll get there. We're going to get there. You know, interesting in this episode and the last couple of episodes, there's been some not so great CGI. And I'll tell you what, when the story is good and the acting is good and you're engaged in that way, the production could be Doctor Who quality, like 1970s, early Doctor Who. I almost said Dr. Seuss. Yeah. And I wouldn't care. because it's I'm so enrolled in what's going on with the characters and what's happening with the plot, and it's so interesting. So that when you start noticing that kind of stuff, you can tell there's something that we got to pick nits and we got to got to criticize and poke at it. So
That's what I was always saying in True Detective, right? Like if I'm noticing those details, we have a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Or you may notice them, but if you complain about them, then that's when we have the problem.
Right. I
will say I watched a little bit more of the miniseries, and I'm debating whether or not the 1980 miniseries, and I'm debating right now whether I should continue watching it or not, because it's like telling me, like if I watch that episode, then I kind of know what's going on. And I'm also kind of remembering because I watched it back then. And so I have latent memories of it. And I'm at the point now, it's like, oh, maybe I want to be surprised and let go and go with the story. I kind of have the story up until about this point already in my head from that. And so then the miniseries was reinforcing that. But at the same time, what's really interesting is to see how this FX production is doing critical changes that are handled so well and so smartly and really bring the story into this better framing and moving it away from Blackthorne as being the white savior trope kind of, right? And there are things that happen, and we'll talk about it later. I'll bring them up here or there. But I knew like the courtesan thing was going to happen, right? That's in the 80s thing. But then the whole thing of training the troops and that stuff, it's handled so very differently in the miniseries. And I have to say, I am just so impressed with the writer's room on this production.
They should pay them in more cuckoos.
It would be definitely. What was the laughing cuckoos or what was it? What did
he say? I don't know. But that he called it a cuckoo somewhere. And that cracked me up.
Yeah, there was a great line. I wrote it down somewhere and I can't find my notes. Anyway, just so smart. The writing staff, the what they've done and how they've done it. And the through lines and the trajectories that they can make, the whole thing, the cannons were not in the 80s miniseries. It was flintlocks and rifles. Well, not rifles, but flintlocks. And he was training him in basic, basic arms of the era. So this whole cannon thing is like, wow, this is really such a great development, a way to recenter the story, but still give Blackthorne that key detail that he needs to give Toranaga a particular edge. You're going to say?
So Nate actually wrote it. Nate's a new member of our Discord.
Nate's been all up in that Discord. It's so cool to see. Welcome, Nate.
Scholar, yes. It seems. And Nate wrote something about the guns in particular that struck me, and I wanted to make sure to include it in the podcast.
Okay.
Even if it wasn't official feedback.
Right.
It's how they were going to make changes to fix Clavel's travesty of Englishman comes and teaches noble savages how to use modern gun technology was one of my biggest concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
The official podcast has the historian they consulted on the show, and he describes telling the writers, not no, but FFF no, are you doing it this way? They had guns for almost 60 years. Basically verbatim what Marico said.
Right.
Switching it to cannons, which were less common in Japan, was an elegant solution.
So elegant. I haven't listened to the official podcast yet, and I haven't been up on the Discord that much as I've been sort of slowly building myself back up. But yeah, sure. I totally agree with him. Elegant, I think, is the exact right word.
Yep, yep.
My last thought, Buntaro is so alive.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You were in the pod last week with Alicia saying that he served his narrative purpose. And I was like,
I mean, he did. Well, maybe not, because he could come back and be like, what are you doing with my wife?
Yeah, it's going down.
He's like, I'm sorry, are you a Hatamoto? Because I don't know. I'm a Hatamoto.
I'm a Hatimoto. Oh, my.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
So what about you? I know you've chimed in on a few thoughts. What else do you have from your hot take side?
Yeah, I've pretty much given most of my hot takes now. Okay. But I love the episode, really. I keep becoming more in on this show.
Mm-hmm.
The acting is amazing. The production value is amazing.
You sound like me.
I know. You're rubbing off on me. My human heart is in conflict with itself.
All three of them.
But really, I mean, I'm so into the lore of it. I have not really had a chance to read more of the book. I've just been swamped with a million things in real life.
Right.
But I can't wait to finish it after this. Like, I'm definitely going to finish the book after the series if I can't finish it before it.
Regardless of what subject matter they might tackle, I really want this production team to do some more work somewhere, something, do something. I don't care. Adaptation, original write, you know, original writing, whatever. These people are delivering this Game of Thrones, House of the Dragons-esque, Succession-esque material that we want. And it's, I just will be really sad when this is over.
Wouldn't it be cool if they did an anthology series where they took different Clavell eras?
Would be so great.
That'd be fun. But we'll see.
That would be, huge. I mean, they've been developing this for so long. But then they had COVID in the way. But still, I think part of what is the quality here is the fact that they have taken their time with the development. Like, they've taken the due care and consideration of working through all of these issues. And I think it really shows.
Right. So you want to talk about history a little bit before we take a break?
Yeah, just a wee bit. I just had a couple of points, notes that I had. I don't know if you had anything on your list.
I just see that you have Natto on the list. I didn't do a history thing on it, but I knew what that was from various media and whatnot. And the first time I learned about it, I was like, my God. And the fact that pretty much the Japanese population understands that this is a disgusting food, but they're like, but it's part of our culture. Sure. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoy it.
Super cool. I mean, if you've ever had a stinky cheese, like a Stilton or something like that, I mean, I could imagine that Blackthorn being, you know, they were dealing with scurvy and, you know, traveling on the world and the food, like I could imagine him being into strong smelling foods, you know, with weird textures. So like the fact that he liked it, I was like, okay, that's great. That's a great little detail. Well, I've never had natto, and I didn't know as much as I do now, which is basically it's a fermented soybean. It's like so fermented that it starts to become sticky and gooey, almost like a mac and cheese, like a stringy thing with a really strong. And what was interesting was that it's often eaten cold and it's often eaten for breakfast, which I don't know that I could do that. Maybe I could do a warm natto, but I don't know about a cold natto. That sounds really,
it tastes sort of like a cheese, maybe a bit spoiled. It's the way he says good. That. He's trying to be nice about it.
And he gained their respect a little bit in that moment, right? They were like, wow, this is really interesting.
They were also kind of giggling at him. But they were like, he definitely hates us.
Yeah. It was very cute. It was, one of those funny scenes in the show. So perfect. I wanted to mention about flintlocks as well, which are an interesting form of armament. It literally is a flint and a lock. So what you do, it's a muzzle loading weapon. So you put powder, a certain amount of powder down the barrel first, then you put like a little piece of paper and a ball, and then you the paper creates a friction seal so that when the powder ignites, it actually creates that explosive force necessary to push the ball down the barrel. So you need the paper and the ball need to be sort of fitted just right. And then you don't want the ball to roll out, right? So you got to really tamp it down there. And then there's this really ingenious mechanism where there's a little pan right next to the side of the barrel with a little hole in the side of the barrel where you put in a small amount of really finely ground powder. And then when you lock the flint, the strike, I forget what the striker thing is called. When you, there's a little cover for the pan that is also part of the metal that the flint will strike against to create the spark. And so that's a single piece that locks down in place. So that powder doesn't come out, but then that there's a little plate there where then you have the hammer with a piece of flint, like literally like a piece of stone, wrapped and grabbed in a little vice grip thing. And then you have to position that just right so that when you pull the trigger, and that thing falls forward. It drags along the face of this metal plate, which I forget the name of, creating a whole bunch of sparks. But as that's moving forward, it's also coming up and opening the pan so that all those sparks shower down and fall into that little pan of powder, which ignites, then goes through that little hole and then ignites the powder that's in the back of the barrel of the gun. It is
interesting.
It's a really elegant way to solve the problem that they were dealing with until they came up with percussion caps and then ultimately cartridges. But when you pull the trigger, you got to wait for a second before all of that happens, and you gotta hold your gun, and then you're done, right? That's it. It's going to take forever to load. So, you know, when you have a regiment or a squad of people who with rifles, with those as rifles, they developed tactics where there'd be first and second and third rows where people would fire and then rotate out and fire and rotate out. Right. So,
yeah. Actually, I have to say that is something that bothered me in Blue Eye Samurai is mm-hmm. that I was like, you are firing a second shot too fast here, yes. guys. This is too fast. But I will tell you, I did finish Blue Eye Samurai the other night.
How was it? Yeah. Good.
Absolutely would have been in my top five last year.
Wow. Like
top five. It was really that good.
Wow.
It was amazing. There was a twist that made me go, and my wife just looked at me like, yeah, that's the twist. I gasped out loud. I was uncontrollable. It was involuntary. So if you like this show, I would say definitely watch Blue Eye Samurai.
Okay. I bounced out of it in the first few minutes when the sidekick was trying to go along mm-hmm. with the protagonist at the, you know, the beginning after the sort of opening things. And I was just kind of like, this just seems a little too Shrek-like with the donkey or something.
You can't do him dirty like that.
I know, but I've heard everybody. It's like universally praised this show. So.
It's amazing. Yeah. It gets better as it goes. And there was a point in episode like 5 or 6 out of 8 where I was like, how is the show going to have 2 more episodes? It seems like everything's done. And then just twist after twist. That all made sense and felt like it had been coming.
Very cool.
And so absolutely, if you like Shogun, go watch Blue Eye Samurai. Get past the fact that it's animated if that bothers you.
Right.
Go watch the show. It's an amazing story.
And get past the first episode, I would guess.
And this is a few decades after Shogun takes place historically. Oh, so it's a similar era.
Right, right, right. So the last historical note I had was on Chain Shot, which is what Blackthorn was loading up at one point when Ishido's men, I believe, came on scene. And of course, then I'm pretty sure it was used the next day when
Nagakato.
Thank you, Nagakato. Has that surprise attack. But a chain shot is kind of important, I think. We'll see if it's going to be important because Blackthorn actually names it specifically. So that's what caught my attention. It's basically, there's different versions of it, but basically it's a single cannonball that's been cut in half and has a piece of chain of varying length connecting the two halves. And the size of this thing could, you know, is going to scale based on the cannon that you're going to use. But in naval warfare, you could use chain shot really effectively against rigging and sails. So it would fly through, you know, as the cannonball shoots out, it can, it'll eventually, the two halves will stretch apart with that chain, and it could even be tumbling as it's going. And then that chain shot going through all the rigging and the ropes and everything on a ship or sails, so you can damage your enemy's ability to actually maneuver. And I think they also used something called bar shot, which is basically two smaller cannonballs that have a single piece of a bar between the two. And so they would try to use those to take out masts of a ship, because if you could dismast your opponent, that was a really effective maneuver, because you could still maneuver and shoot where they are, you know, pretty much stuck. The unfortunate downside of chain shot is it's an extremely effective anti-personnel weapon. And so really, as we saw, I think, to devastating effect at the end of the episode. So So that's Chain Shot. Those are my three historical notes for this episode.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, David. And certainly some context to Nagakato's insanity. Let's take a quick break. When we get back, we'll get into the actual character arcs.
Great.
And we're back. So let's talk about the man of the hour, John Blackthorne.
John Blackthorne. I am John
He's
Blackthorne.
Faking it till he makes it.
Yes.
I love the beginning. So it's not just that they changed it from guns to cannons, right?
Yeah.
It's that he goes in going, well, they don't even know how to load a gun, so I'll teach them the basics and they'll think I'm a genius. And they're like, we don't need to know the basics. Show us tactics. Let me tell you about a battle. And they know so he's bullshitting funny. So fast.
The whole thing when he starts, you know, going on about the Battle of Malta was hilarious. Absolutely. And he sounded very professorial. It was just like, no.
It's taught.
Yes.
That was really good. But it really flips it on the head, right? It's not the white savior. It's this guy who they're like, any expertise you have, go ahead and share it with the class, because we know the basics already. You know, we graduated high school. We're ready for university level courses. Mm-hmm. And he thinks about it for a second. He's like, all right, I don't know how to do gun warfare.
Right. Yeah. Infantry
based. A lot about piracy, yeah. Basically.
Right.
And so the cannons and a perfectly done scene where Yabushige goes, look, the Portuguese have tried to show us this before. We weren't very impressed. He's like, hold my beer. Hold my natto. Mm-hmm. And he just hits the target. It was beautiful. It was great.
Yeah. And I was really nervous. The moment that they said, well, we know how to shoot guns, I was like, oh, crap. I was like, what is he going to do? He was really jammed. But I think it goes to showing us who this character is. He's a survivor. He's quick on his feet. He has a strong sense of morality, even though it's, you know, based in his country's morality as opposed to, you know, Japanese morality.
The honor of women.
Yes, exactly. Is no one going to stop him? And that he's also getting, he's got an aptitude for language. And so that he is in that moment able to think so quickly on his feet and actually be competent with the cannon firing is just really good. It's just a really great way to let us know that this, you know, Blackthorne is not going to die. He's going to keep pulling an ace out of his sleeve every time something happens. And I think that's an interesting arc for us to follow. That's not a white savior complex, right? You know, teaching the barbarians, he's the savage.
It's not even that, right? It's more, here are two people from civilized, here are two groups of people that are civilized societies that each have their own kinds of wisdom. How do we have those mix
nice.
And teach each
yeah.
other?
Yeah.
The right. Like they're not flipping it on its head necessarily. They're
correct.
Reframing it entirely.
Yeah.
And in a really wonderful way. And, you know, we lose this thing about language you mentioned. We lose this because it's all English and Japanese. Mm-hmm. But this guy already speaks at least three languages. He's on a Dutch ship. He know he speaks Portuguese and he's from England.
Right.
He speaks at least three languages. They always say, you know, you speak two languages, you could speak three pretty easily. And I think that shows he's a really smart guy, right?
He's a navigator. To do celestial navigation. Oh my God. Right. They didn't have GPSs. They didn't have maps. They didn't have topographic and nautical maps. He's keeping all of that stuff in a written book. And then refreshing his memory by reading his rudder, right?
Right. And Alicia made a great point last week, which was four other ships did not make it.
Right.
He was the only one out of five.
Yeah.
He's the only one who made it through Magellan's Pass, or Magellan's Pass, as he said.
Yes, Magellan's Pass. And to have that strength of will, as well as that quick-witted intelligence, is I think it's really demonstrated. And so It was just fun to see him pull out the rabbit out of his hat in the canon situation.
Yeah. He's also oddly respectful to Fuji-sama. You mm-hmm. know, he's really like, and not in like a I have to protect women way, but more like, look, I don't want to bother her with me. Like, I'm not trying to mm-hmm. go and take advantage of all these things. I don't want this house. I don't want you to throw a woman at me like she's property. Mm-hmm. I just want to go home, basically. I just want my men. I want my ship.
Right.
And, you know, part of it is part of his tantrum of I'm not getting what I thought I bargained for. But part of it, I think he really is being kind to her. You know, he gives her the gun later. He mm-hmm. he shows her respect the whole time. And I think that's actually what charms Mariko in the end.
Right.
You know, the date is one thing, but he doesn't get to the fake date without the respect for Fuji-sama. I mean, right. Mariko even explicitly calls it out later when she's like, he's trying to be kind.
I think it goes into a larger question of his character, which is his character. One of his characteristics is adaptability. He can mm-hmm. adapt to situations, and he knows he can read a room, and he can gather the little bits of information that he needs to adapt himself. But then I think actually, the more I think about it, it's not just adaptability, though. But he's actually beginning to take on board some of what they're saying. Like, there's a one scene where he's sitting there looking at the rocks, right, at the garden at right. night and right. listening. And he's in the morning after the visit from the courtesan, he's sitting with them having breakfast and looking out, you know, or he's talking to Fuji about the rain, right? He's actually beginning to appreciate, to see and appreciate. And if he wasn't self-reflective like that, if he was just a mm-hmm. Inflexible, I think he'd already be dead by now.
Yeah, definitely. He's flexible, but he also does sort of stand up for himself when he
exactly
needs to,
at
right?
the same time. Yeah, he doesn't
has a strong moral compass too.
Yeah, yep.
And
that's a good point.
It's really interesting, like the way he rejects basically using Fuji. I think he understood that they were saying this recently widowed woman, she's going to be essentially your sex servant.
Right.
And he's like, I don't, that's not for me, guys. That's just not for me.
Well, yeah, it's part of, that's one part of a household, right? A male.
Right.
Male,
and he's like, I don't agree
household.
With that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting character. Very interesting. I like him.
Yep.
Now, of course, there was an adversary to Blackthorn in this episode, mm-hmm. and Omi was really just determined to piss Blackthorn off.
Yep. Yep.
What was that? Was it just a power play, you think? Was it just, I am still higher ranked than you, maybe?
I think there's a couple things going on, actually. I think one was the fact that, how did the guns come off the boat? Somebody got the guns off the boat, and everything on that boat is, you know, not the property of Blackthorn anymore, right?
Yeah.
It's property of Toranaga ultimately. So how did the guns get into his hands?
Mm-hmm. Didn't Mariko-sama, didn't she offer, if you need something off the boat, just tell us and we'll get it? And it was for the training, right? So he was going to say, I'm bringing the guns for the training.
Yeah.
I think that's probably how he got them. That's my headcanon.
Yeah, but then who authorized that? And if Omi was not part of that authorization, you know, chain, then mm-hmm. why is he demanding the guns? But I think there's
another
thing.
He's not
part
of the authorization chain, right? Like, he's the head of the village, but he's not at all part of this training regimen, which is led by Yabusige. Oh, my God. I got to get all these names right. Yabushige,
yep.
And Nagakato.
Right.
Those are the people ahead of Blackthorn.
But he's still a vassal of Toranaga. So he's still part of the overall authority and hierarchy. The other thing I think, though, is that, correct me if I'm wrong, write in if you know, but I believe at this stage, possession of firearms was strictly controlled. And I don't think that, like, anybody just walking down the street with a firearm, unless they had authorization from, you know, a higher authority, I think that was off limits, because they are such a game changer of a weapon in this day and age. So I think that's my headcanon, is that you can't leave this domicile area with a firearm. And then he's just like, then he tried to pull the power play of, you know, after he gave him to Fuji, you know, give me the guns. And then she was like, not having it.
That was excellent.
Yeah.
That was, I mean, I'd liked her character before that, but I was unsure about where she was going. That was the moment where I was like, she's got a personality. You know what I mean? She's not just a one dimensional character of this grieving widow being forced into an uncomfortable situation.
And the fact that she is fulfilling her role as a courtesan, as the
consort.
Consort. Sorry, I apologize. Consort. I had courtesan because I was reading, I was trying to read up on some of those as a consort and head of his household. And that's the interesting thing is when everybody's got these like strict moral or honor codes that dictate them. Like if we go back to, I got to look up his name, the guy who, her former husband, he was Tadayoshi. When he was hearing his lord getting insulted and he was like, you're dishonoring and it's my job to be responsible for the honor of my lord. Mm-hmm. And so I've got to say and do something. And then, whoops, that was not the thing to say or do in that particular moment.
Well, it's and so everybody like set up, command, right? It's you know, you have that in an office setting at work, right?
Sure.
It's just a head of a department has to ask, has to challenge another head of department. I can't go challenge your head of department.
Right.
You know,
right,
things
right.
like that. It's, yeah. It's, but now I would get written up and not have to, you know, commit to seppuku. But that's the point, right? Is there was, there's a reason why, right? I think Hatamoto is probably very similar to the rank of Omi.
Right. And, but the, what I think I'm pointing at is everybody are on these trajectories and these trajectories are going to invariably cross. And then that's where you get drama, right? And I think this, it's a great subject area. And I think this is why there's so much written in, you know, plays and movies and books and all kinds of stuff around this particular period of Japan is because it is so rich from a literary standpoint in terms of dramatic tension and characters who are on these, you know, they're on these railway tracks and they have to go from here to there because their honor code demands it. And that's invariably going to lead them into collisions with other people whose codes are crossing theirs. And it's great. It's very rich.
Yeah, definitely. So Fuji, I didn't do a separate section for Fuji.
Yes.
Cause I feel like she kind of interwove between Blackthorn and Mariko.
Mm-hmm.
But I really love this moment for her. I think this was her moment of the show and what a great shot of her just holding the gun with her sleeves.
Yep.
Yep. Amazing. Amazing camera work.
If we're a little bit on Fuji-sama right now, Fuji-san-sama, Fuji, this moment, there's a great scene or a great look when they're having breakfast after, you know, the morning after. And she looks over at Mariko-sama and there's like this little like eyebrow facial thing. And it was so good. The acting was just so brilliant.
Yeah.
At the beginning when they're on the boat and she's pissed off that she's being given this assignment, the delivery that, let me look up the actor's name here. The delivery that she gave, Hoshi. Her last name is Hoshi. Hoshi gave was just so subtle and nuanced with just this passion and fury. And she's so pissed off. And then she goes, oh, I'm so sorry. How beastly of me not to be sympathetic to your own loss. And so she immediately goes into her little eightfold fence, scenario, right?
Yeah.
And buries her own feelings. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. You see all these examples of the eightfold fence as
you're looking
for them, right? And I thought that was a beautiful way to frame the episode.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But speaking of emotions, I think Blackthorn can be a little romantic when he wants to be, but he does know when to shut up. I will say that, you know, the morning after he tries to kiss and tell, America's like, yeah, I hope you really like your courtesan.
So
that
funny.
Was a very generous gift.
Yes, it was. It was very good. And that happens in the miniseries as well. But I think Buntaro is still alive in the miniseries. So that's why they have to even be more careful about their secrecy there.
Hmm.
So this whole thing, we'll talk about it when we get to Mariko's whole section later on. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole thing about their what's forming the basis of their relationship. So
yeah. And I just want to say, Blackthorn, our guy, finally has his swords.
He shows up in this village. He's a smelly barbarian, half-starved, dead guy. They cart him off, and then he comes back Hatamoto with swords.
But like, as he points out, he's a prisoner still with better quarters.
But aren't a lot of them prisoners in their own? I think that's what Mariko feels
behind their eightfold fence.
Exactly, because they're all so formally slotted into this structure that they're all prisoners in a way.
Yeah.
So
she says something this episode that's like, you know, we live and then we die, and that's it.
That's it.
That's what we have to count on.
Right. Right. I do love the way that Blackthorn is fussing with his swords when they're out in the morning for that demonstration. Yeah, he's trying to get them in the 80s miniseries. He just wears them perfectly and he struts around with them, and it's just so hilarious. And in this one, he's just so bumbling and foolish, and he's like trying to, you know, they're so weird. He probably cut himself if he tried to actually draw one of those.
Yeah. Fun stuff. Shall we move on to Yabushige and Nagakado, our two commanders? Are they in the infantry still, or are they now the Navy?
I think they're Marines. That's what Marines are.
Okay.
The infantry of the Navy.
The infantry of the Navy. Yeah. That. Yabushige, you know, we were debating last week, who is he loyal to? I think we know as well as he does at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He's loyal to himself, as Alicia said at one point.
Yes, yeah, agreed.
But boy, does he not know which side to pick.
Well, and he's in such a bind, right? Yeah. He's so stuck because he's got open allegiances to, well, not open, but he's so in the pocket for Ishido. But the moment he says he's not with Toranaga, you know, that's it from that side. So he's completely in a really rock and a hard place.
So I think this is my thought on where he's at. If there were no oaths, he would be with Ishido because he thinks Ishido is stronger.
And they're buddies, right? They swapped war stories at one point in, I think, episode 2.
Yeah. Yeah. But, one, there are oaths, and there are harsh consequences for breaking oaths in the society.
Right. And his territory is probably well inside of Toranaga's territory as well.
Yeah,
right?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. He is a vassal of Toranaga, right?
Yeah.
He controls a large part of Toranaga's territory. But also, by the end of this episode, he's basically cemented in being on Team Toranaga.
Now he is.
I mean, he's the commander of this group, and they kill everybody who came to check on him. Like, they're not sending anybody back. He's done. He's done. That's who he's on the side of now.
Yeah, there's no.
And that's why he's
no
so panicked
this.
At the end, right? Mm-hmm. It's because he's pretty sure that Toranaga is going down. He was trying to figure out. You know, he's talking to Omi like, well, maybe if Toranaga goes down, I will then have the guns, and then I can go and do my own thing. Omi's telling him to play both sides, basically, and just pick the winner side and give them the guns.
Yeah, basically. And he was already sort of upstaged when his troops started shouting Toranaga's.
Yes.
Name so he's feeling he doesn't have a good footing anywhere. I mean, if he would just be okay, I'm 100% Toranaga, he'd have a position, right? But he's in a really slippery slope right now.
Right. But I think also, you know, we were debating last week too why Toranaga would put him in charge when he has such dubious loyalty, and I think Toranaga knows that. And
absolutely.
Something I posited is keep your enemies close, and that implicating him in this plot forces him to be a part of it and forces him to be on this side. And if that was the plan, 5D chess. 5D chess well. For Onaga.
Seriously. Just like the way that he used Blackthorn and Blackthorn's quote-unquote execution, or like, you know, how, what do we do with him? The, mm-hmm. That he predicted how it would play amongst the other the three Christian regents, and how that would separate them from Ishido. So he's looking exactly 5D chess moves down the way.
Right.
So I don't know that he would have predicted that his son would have started a war.
No,
stage.
That's a question I want to pose when we get to Omi, which is okay. The next section.
Okay.
But so Yabushige really, I would say, throws himself into this canon training, right? The minute he's impressed with it, he's like, yes,
yeah,
this is the thing to do. And it's kind of interesting to watch him really be passionate about something and not just be the plotter, but be like, yeah. He's like watching football on Sunday. Yeah, right. He's having a great time with Blackthorn.
Well,
but
and
you see Nagakato next to him. Mm-hmm. Being so insecure and just like, and it really, it felt very natural. It felt like the son of a great leader feeling like he's in the shadow, and then being placed second to this guy who he knows his dad doesn't really like very much, and that his dad doesn't really trust. Dad, why won't you put me in charge? You can trust no one, son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. And why did he put his son with? That's a really good question. What's the chess move there? I mean,
it's to watch him, I think. It's two things. It's actually three things. I'm going to say three now. One, to watch him and learn. Two,
right,
to hold Yabushige accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Three, so that when somebody has to take the fall for this plan, his son can have plausible deniability as number two.
Right, right. I mean, I can totally see how it's trapped Yabushige. He can't, there's just no matter what happens, Yabushige is just, he's ensnared.
Yeah.
There's no way for him to get out.
And Yabushige kind of gets that when he learns that Torunaga resigned from the council. He's like, oh my God, we're dead. He literally walks up to him and goes, so you're going to kill yourself now, right? He's like, oh, thank you for the suggestion, Yabushige. So
funny. He's,
but no.
The delivery of that line was so funny. It was so good.
Yeah. Torunaga wasn't in this episode much, but where he was great.
So should we talk about Torunaga just now? I don't see.
Oh, yeah, because he's there for like two minutes. So I didn't even give him his own section.
Well, I'll save it for the favorite section, because I have a favorite moment.
I've got the council later.
Okay.
I've got the council. We'll talk about the council politics. That's our last section.
Well, I've got a Torunaga. Torunaga's in my favorite moments for the episode. So I'll save that till then.
All right. Fair enough. You know, let's just move on to Omi, because that's pretty much what instigates this whole thing.
Yeah.
What was Omi's intended outcome of talking to Nagakato? Was it this? Because I don't think so.
I don't think it was this. I think he was goading him into doing something foolish that would embarrass himself or would get him in trouble. Because Omi's trying to get his uncle, because he wants his uncle to move up so that he can move up, right?
Right.
Like it's very, you know, everybody in the chain of command, it doesn't matter.
I can't get promoted until you do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to get him to get promoted. Is he really on Ishido's side or Torunaga's side, or is he just on Yabushige's side?
I think he's just on Yabushige's side. I think he would love to see Yabushige be the fifth
council member. Got it. So I, you know, what the specific action that he was trying to get Nagakato to do, I don't know that he had something in mind other than to goad him into doing something childish and stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, should we write to your dad? No. Let's not write to my dad.
Write to your dad. And then like
yeah.
forcing him to do that, not realizing that he was going to actually be so, he's so, what's the word I want to say? He's so insecure, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Insecure about his position that he takes even a more I don't think anybody could have seen this coming.
Yeah, we talked about the gun deal, but I think Omi just in general is really into goading in this episode, both Blackthorn and Omi, but it doesn't work on Blackthorn. Blackthorn just insults him in English and then hands the guns to his wife. But yeah, I think Blackthorne is somebody who's been in some goad fights before. Who is used to banter with the boys.
Yeah, and Blackthorne's survived a lot, right? He's been through a lot of battles. So one dude, like he was going to smoke Omi. He had no problem doing that. No problem.
You put Omi and Blackthorne in a room with a translator and you have them do a rap battle. And man, I don't think Omi walks away alive.
No. He would take him to pieces.
No.
Yeah. Kiku, however, what's Kiku, his courtesan? What is she up to?
That's his wife.
That's not his wife. She's a courtesan.
Are you sure?
Yeah. We have
it.
She's
his wife.
She was introduced at the, I believe, episode one.
Right.
During the aforementioned scene, which shall not be named anymore because it'll spike the Pequila rating on our show.
Yeah. So the reason actually that I thought it was his wife was because one, he said he loved her.
Yes.
The other thing was there was a whole thing in the book in Omi's inner monologue, because the book bounces around everybody's POV, where Omi basically says, like, I know my uncle Yabushige is really into my wife, so I sent her away before Yabushige could come, because it's used in a really brilliant way to like teach you about sort of honor. And he's like, well, if Yabushige actually did anything to my wife, I would have to kill him.
Exactly.
Which would cause a whole problem.
Right.
And so just to avoid that whole situation, I'm going to send her away. Anyway, interesting stuff. But that's clearly I misread this whole scene. So I'm just going to let you talk about it.
So I think that I don't know whose side she's on. If she's on Omi's side, if she's on her own side, if she's got some other play. I don't think they've given us enough to know other than to say that Kiku is up to something. There was the scene when they're talking and she's playing the musical instrument, which I don't know the name of, little stringed instrument. They are talking and scheming, and the scene ends with the camera on her looking like, and she's starting to think. And then obviously when she's with Omi later and she's saying, batting her eyes, wistfully, oh, couldn't you be our lord? So she's pushing some agenda, but who's, we don't know yet. So I think we need to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, definitely. But we shan't figure it out this episode. Instead, we'll talk about another woman who I think we understand more, Mariko.
Yeah, Mariko-sama.
The Eightfold Fence.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that first and frame this a bit.
Yeah.
This idea that you build this fence within your mind and you hide behind it in peace so that you don't react to things, it's really just intentional dissociating.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually a really good way to put it, actually. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's exactly what it is.
I think Blackthorne's kind of like, that's sort of fucked up, man. Like, it's so interesting because this is a whole culture based around dissociating for honor.
Right.
And a therapist in our culture would be like, yeah, that's incredibly unhealthy. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. You should like know what you're feeling.
You should know. Yeah. But then I think let's contrast it with an earlier scene when Blackthorne's trying to get back out to his ship.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to get Miraji to help him. Remember, he's the spy too in the village, right? Because they're still looking for the spy. Miraji's like, no, we can't go. And then, Mariko comes and says, no, you can't go out. And he gets pissed off and he throws the oar on the ship around, right? He like slams it down. He's sort of a big baby tantrum. And she just looks at him just like, bro, like control yourself, right? That's not how you do it. So he's not doing Eightfold Fence in that particular situation.
But at the same time, look at his honor of women scene and
which saves them.
Not having an old, yeah, exactly. Him not having this dissociation saves them. Everyone's like, well, we're all terrified right now because our leader is about to get discovered. And at least some of us, a lot of us are going to die.
Is no one going to stop him?
Remain silent for honor. And he's like, the honor of women. And that just saves them all. His idiocy saves them all.
And I think this goes back to your point earlier about these two, we're looking at two cultures with two different cultural imperatives. And by putting them together in this situation, it's a really interesting story as opposed to, oh, well, here's the European civilized guy who's going to teach the barbarians what's correct in the world.
It's like peanut butter and jelly. It just goes together like no tomorrow.
I found a really interesting article on the Eightfold Fence, but I can't find it now. And I started to read it last night, but I couldn't get through it. There's no Wikipedia article on the Eightfold Fence, but there is a bunch of other writings on it. It's a thing that's out there. So I definitely want to read about it a little bit more and see what the scholars have to say.
For sure. For sure. I mean, I would say we even see the Eightfold Fence in play largely when Mariko is being really cold with Fuji, when Fuji's like, you know, I just went through all this and now I have to do this. And Mariko just sits there and she doesn't say a word. She just stands there and stares at her. And Fuji talks herself into doing it. And she's like, oh, that was cruel of me to bring that up when mm-hmm. you were just widowed.
Yep. Yep.
And her fence just got the reaction that she wanted.
Yep. It's really good. She put herself right into that spot. Trained, right? Trained yep. since she was yep. a kid. So.
Yeah. Inside of their shared language. Did you write this?
I did write this. Inside okay. of their like, shared language.
I was like, who wrote this? I don't know what this is.
It's not. It was in a different font, so you didn't recognize it. And it's a half-baked thought written down because my...
tell me about it.
My fingers and my brains aren't connecting well together quite just yet. This idea that Blackthorn and Mariko-sama have a world unto themselves because of language. And it's not the same as an Eightfold Fence situation, but it's this mm-hmm. sense of privacy, this private world that they can share. And doesn't she say in one of the previous episodes that, you know, there's no privacy in this world. Like you're constantly around. And in Blackthorn even gets frustrated with Fuji. She's like, she's just following me around. Just tell her to go away. Like, I just want to like hang out and go to sleep or whatever. And so in this world, Mariko-sama is a lady. She's got this past that is tragic that we got glimpses of. She's a vassal of her lord. She has roles and responsibilities within her society. She's taken all the notes during the battle training, right, during the canon training. So she's like mm-hmm. kind of a spy as well, or an observer, you know, for her lord. And yet here in this language, here's this big, goofy puppy dog, you know, European guy who actually is, you know, has been charming them. And in this world where they two exist, she gets to exist outside of her roles and strictures in the Japanese society.
Right.
And she can be this other person. And I won't say authentic self, because I don't think that that's the appropriate way to frame this particular part of the conversation. Because it's not that she's unauthentic in her Japanese life, but there's a different expression of her that can come out in this conversational space with Blackthorn. And it's just really interesting that they have this private world where they too can exist in, and she gets to exist in this new and different way. She gets to express herself in a way that she doesn't get to express herself anywhere else. And I think that's what ultimately leads to her wanting to pillow with him.
I can show you the world. So our resident expat, Alicia,
uh-huh.
actually wrote in the Discord that...
Well, she's no longer an expat. She's actually a patriot, a Dutch patriot.
Okay. Well, all right. Whatever. Our Dutch woman, Alicia, wrote that she tends to be more direct in Dutch than in English, because mm-hmm. when you're in a foreign language, you sometimes are more blunt or open because it feels like you're a little bit more removed from the statements.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really interesting take on Mariko.
So a whole other world, a whole lifetime ago, we had some in our friend group, we had this one friend of ours who was from Russia. And he came over to the United States to study and work. And then he married his now wife is of Russian descent, but grew up in France, you know, so French Russian, right? Because there are a whole bunch of Russians left and went to France at particular times. And they both spoke English, Russian, and French. And we were hanging out in France one time, and I was with them, and they had just had their, I think, first kid. Anyway, something happened where we kind of got sort of locked out of the house, and the kid, and we'd been out at Versailles during the day or whatever. And it was so funny seeing them trying to do this little problem solving and switching between Russian, English, or French, depending on the particular thought that they were trying to get across, the particular technicality of the got to break the window or pick this lock or do this thing, or when they were emotionally upset and the different languages that they would follow, because they were equally fluent in all three languages. And watching them switch languages so quickly to express these different things was fascinating to watch. So I totally get why Alicia could say, like, in this situation or that situation.
Definitely. And, you know, we actually had a lot of really good talk about language in general. I'm actually going to bring in a piece of feedback here because it's short and it's really applicable. Joe H. wrote in and said, great show, though I do have a question or nitpick. I don't remember if this came up in your discussion of the last episode, but how would Mariko be able to translate Blackthorne's logbook? He's an Englishman piloting a Dutch ship, so he's not going to record things in Portuguese, the language of his enemies, which is what he uses to speak with Mariko. No one in Japan knows English or Dutch. Cincinnati Joe. Oh, I didn't introduce you as Cincinnati Joe. My apologies, Joe. Cincinnati Joe.
That's a really good question, actually.
Nate came to the rescue, however.
Okay.
In the Discord without even being asked the question.
All right, good.
Apparently in the book, which I haven't gotten up to this part, in the book, Blackthorne and Mariko also both speak Latin and switch to Latin whenever someone around them speaks Portuguese. He's glad that they didn't try to shoehorn that in, but it seems like, this is my charitable read on this, maybe the logbook is in Latin.
So when I was watching the episode, there was a scene that caught my eye where she's looking through the rudder. And there's a piece of paper that's not bound in the book. It's sort of like a loose leaf of piece of paper. And she takes that out and then she looks at it. And the camera gives us a little close up really quickly, but very quickly, so quickly that you can't really read it. And then it moves on. I rewound it several times, got a good picture of it. And I've got it in the ship's rudder for the episode notes. And I think it might be in Latin. There's an English translation, burn to hell, with circled,
yes,
with a line, inferno, yes. And then there's like hell is something, and then there's some other line, you know. So I think that there may be some, I wonder if there is some Latin in there.
Yeah. Good question. And the Portuguese clearly knew either Dutch or English, whatever this was in. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think that's a good question and a decent answer from Nate.
I hope that the showrunners and the writers are smart enough to have already thought this through and are anticipating that we're starting to question that. That would be very cool. Then in a couple of episodes, the answer to that actually materializes. Yeah. I think I'll be really impressed with this show that they played five-dimensional chess with us. That would be great.
Yeah, I'll also say if they just overlook that detail, I'm totally fine with that.
The story as well, right. Enough. Expediency for the plot. Yeah.
Yep. Let's talk about the flashbacks that Mariko is having. What was going on there?
I also took pictures. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pictures in the ship's rudder for that as well. There's a picture of a guy looking very frightened, sort of an intense look. Then there's a picture of her running the snow. Then there's a picture of two hands clasping and maybe a third hand in the middle with what looks to be kind of like a rosary or like a beaded necklace of some kind. And then there's a picture of her in the snow, sort of close up, looking very young. She looks very like half the age here. with somebody standing behind her with a sword at their hip and looking very, very serious, looking like something right out of Night Country, actually. These two photos look right out of Night Country.
So it does they look like Night Country, yeah.
They purposely have not given us enough information.
Yep. Yep. Well, it's super interesting. It does look like she went through quite a lot of trauma back there.
Right. And her family name has been like dishonored. Like she would have rather, because this is part of the tension with her and Fuji, is we are obliged to continue serving our Lord. And if our Lord doesn't give us leave to unalive ourselves, then we have to carry on no matter how painful that is. And know how difficult that burden is. Right. And so I think Mariko-sama's shame is even more so than Fuji. At least Fuji's sort of expunged, regardless of the fact that her baby is like, you know, like.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine.
Setting aside the horror of that.
Yep.
It's well, I don't know. Well, you can't. I don't think
Let's
we should
not
be
play
measuring
the Greek Olympics, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's where I was going. Trauma is trauma. So, but something really happened, and I think it's gonna play a big role later down the road. Obviously, right?
Well, I'm looking forward to finding out.
Yes.
For now, I want to point out, you know, I mentioned this before, but she's really trying to get Fuji and Blackthorn to get along. This whole he's trying to be kind thing, you know, be nice to each other. Blackthorn doesn't need to be told. He was actually very good from the beginning. But
yeah.
But Fuji was really not having it.
Well, she's also trying to relate to him as a Hatamoto and the head of the household. And so she's following the forms, doing what she knows what to do, but he doesn't.
Right.
So that's the conflict there, right? She's like, this is, you'd yell at me if I didn't do this. Well, he would yell anyway, because he's just John Blackthorn.
Well, I did really love by the end of the episode, and she does this a couple times, but she's, you know, correcting his Japanese, trying to really help him. You know, she tries to make him do the tonal part of it.
Yep, yep.
Which is another extremely difficult thing about non-romantic languages is the tonal aspect, I think, for us who grew up with romantic languages where we can just talk like this and you can still understand what we're saying. Like John Blackthorn, I could just talk like this all day and people could understand what I'm saying.
I was going to say I had a thought about something. Oh, I know. It was in the 80s miniseries, and it may be this way in the book. The commandment from Toranaga was not to train troops, but to go learn language and go and learn Japanese as quickly as possible. And they actually put the whole town is set to that thing. And basically like, well, everybody in the town's going to die if you don't learn Japanese. So, you know, but you better learn Japanese.
Oh, gosh. That's not great.
No, as opposed
to an incentive.
Where this one is he's learning the language as a byproduct of them doing the military training. And in the 80s miniseries, it was learn language. And then, I'll show you guys how to shoot as a byproduct of me just being around here. So it's sort of in an inverted situation.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I do love, too, how Mariko is just translating Blackthorn so charitably when he's like, I'll piss on your skivvies. And she goes, with the utmost respect, the Anjin son. it's very funny. It's very funny. It's
well, again, the humor of this show is so spot on. And it makes these deadly situations a lot more palatable, ultimately. Can you imagine if Martin Father Alvito was translating? Well, he insulted your mother and all of her generations before her.
Right. You ever watch those videos of the people who pretended to be sign language translators?
No, I have no idea.
Do you know about this?
No,
there's been two separate people who've been caught faking their resumes about ASL translation, and they're doing like government functions.
What?
And
you can't. They're just
doing like dances with their
ridiculous.
Hands. People finally, you know, call in and are like, hey, just so you know, they're doing gibberish and we'd like them to not. And anyway, I'm just wondering, should we get that for Blackthorn? Something like that.
Possibly. Quite possibly.
Mariko-san sama is actually is absolutely charmed by Blackthorn's imaginary London date, and later she takes her reward.
How was that for a beautiful, perfectly situated hot springs over the cliff looking out into
the
ocean?
I guess it wasn't, it probably wasn't an accident, right? They probably built it.
You sure, right. There was a natural spring because that then the they, town. Yeah, they, yeah, they, the town but right it was there. Like, it's like, dang, that is, that you could charge a lot of money for that.
I know. But there, that's just how you bathe.
Who was it? Did somebody post that? Would I see that in the Discord, the Twitter repost in the Discord about somebody saying about, yeah, here it is. There's a very funny a picture of somebody who was very enticed by Blackthorn's date and wanting to find out more details. It was hilarious.
That's pretty funny. It was she very cute that. and it was very wholesome. And I love that their backs were turned towards each other. That mm-hmm. was really, I don't know, there was something intimate about it.
Yeah, no, it was done really well. Way he when he comes out of the water and he sort of covers himself and they sit there. Yeah, it was very sweet.
He really respects the honor of women, as we know. we talked about her morning comment of, oh yeah, we hope you like the courtesan. So mm-hmm. we don't have to recap that, but any other thoughts on it, Mariko?
Just that she played it so perfectly that morning. Like, there was no way to know, right? She was
and the way he's about to ask, like, what are you doing in here? And she just puts her hand on his mouth, like, shut the heck up. We are going to do some things right now.
Yep.
And you are going to be quiet.
The cloud and the rain, right?
Yep.
The moment of cloud and rain or whatever. So.
The council, David.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about him. Toranaga has resigned, slowing down operations, but Ishido sends Jozen to check on Yabushige.
Yeah.
Jozen, of course, was chosen for a terrible mission.
Yes. Unbeknownst to everybody involved. The idea that he's not upset that he's been completely dismembered, but that he's dying in an undignified and manner.
Right.
You blew me up. How uncivilized of you, you savage barbarians, right? You shot me with a cannon from the woodline, 200, 300 yards away. And I think we were talking about this a little bit before, this idea that whenever warfare changes and the technology changes, this idea of like, well, that's uncivilized. That's barbaric. How could you drop bombs from the air? That's ridiculous, right? And it's like, well, yeah, if you're on the other side of that technology change and you didn't know it was coming, you certainly would probably try to find some defenses to your honor in that regard. So, yeah, right, Jozen was not happy.
It's a poor workman who blames his tools.
Well, and it does go – there is a point at least with – Japanese swordsmanship, right? Where this idea of, that you're training and that you're sort of one with your blade and, these efficient movements and you strike and all of that kind of stuff versus just getting shot with a piece of artillery from across the way.
Right.
It is insulting in the sense of, I've trained for years to be a beautiful artist and now some, ChatGPT, BS can make art almost as good as mine, right? That's, I get it, right?
Yeah, I get it. At the same time, get good.
Yeah, right. It's
I
here.
Think that's what John Blackthorne would say, right? Is tough shit, we're gonna win the war.
Right.
Yeah. Yabushige, we mentioned, is playing both sides. He's trying to avoid seppuku. And he offers a display of power. Like, what was the plan here, right? So you offer a display of power. You basically say, sure, let's go, but I'm going to show you how good this stuff is. That way, when you bring me to Ishido, he will bargain with me. Is that?
Or I say, Jozen, you go back and you say, I'll tell when the time comes, I'll turn my guns around and declare for you. So that's what he wanted to show Jozen, that he has these guns and what they can do, so that then Ishido has a ace in the hole that he can play.
Yep.
Which is
okay.
Yabushige turning the guns on Toranaga in the right moment.
That's rough. That's a rough
very go. Rough. Yeah.
Not as rough as what Nagakato does. Nagakato effectively blows up the piece along with the body parts.
Yeah. And yeah, well, and now they're just gone, right? There's no, there's, they're, what happens? What do you send their heads back in boxes?
I don't know if their heads are still intact.
Or do you just do, you know, do you do like Dune and feed them to the worms, you know, where, and there's just no evidence left. So, but there's a lot of people who saw that. So I'm sure somebody's, you know, there's got to be other little spies around too.
Right.
Right. Word's going to get around.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Let's trade a couple favorite moments.
Sure.
David. I really love seeing Blackthorn be sweet and the, you know, the gun gift, the imaginary date. I thought we saw a side of Blackthorn that we hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And relatedly, I really like the hilarious translations by Mariko.
Right.
But it was also nice seeing Fuji become more comfortable with Blackthorn. I really, the interpersonal relationships this episode were the highlight, I thought.
Mm, nice.
And also with you, what's your favorite moments?
I've got three of them particularly that really wowed me.
Tree.
What? Is there, are you, is this a bit?
I'm being New York.
Okay, got it. Huge, huge.
What's a ute? All right, go on.
Toranaga bowing was so baller. Like, it is Toranaga who bows humbly before you. Mm. And he's got the whole fan thing going, and he's all kind of, he's like Randy Macho Man Savage. You know, he's like shaking and like, you know, really, really getting into it. And it was just such an amazing performance by Hirooki Sanada. It was so good. But the real baller move was when everybody turns around and he's already on the boat, halfway back to his boat. He's just like, out, I'm gone. And nobody knows, right? They're just like, oh, okay, let's go have some sake and whatever. And they're like, wait, huh? It was so, it's just, it cracked me the hell up. It was so great to see, and it was just very cool acting. It was very awesome. The other thing that my other two favorite moments are both Fuji related. When Fuji gives him the swords, like, that was super touching, and it was just really a cool gesture. And I just, I think I called it out in the previous episode where we lingered on a shot of her family swords from her husband, right? And so that they were going to come back into play. So perfect way to bring those back in. But the other really great moment was when Fuji yells at Blackthorn and she says, "Anjin-sama!" And she like says, like, "Knock it off, give me the gun," right? This is like ridiculous. Yeah. And she just gives it, she just belts at him and it jolts everybody. And it just was such a beautiful moment of her character exerting dominance and agency in the moment, in the expediency of the moment. So yeah, those are my two other favorites.
Just so many powder kegs in this episode. Mm-hmm. And the one that exploded was the worst one.
Right.
Well, we'll see where that goes next week.
Yeah.
For now, David, we have one piece of feedback I wanted to bring in. We had some more, but I've interspersed it.
Right.
You wove it in. I'm weaving the weaves.
Are we in the Wheel of Time again? What's that?
Are we in the Wheel of Time again?
No, we are not. We're not there yet.
Are you sure? You sure?
I'm sure.
I'm stalling because I'm finding the email. Okay. Here we go. Michael and Sally G wrote in and said, thanks so much for the great way you're diving into the Shogun series. If you haven't already, you may want to dive into James Clavell, the novel's author. It seems his first experience with Japanese culture came through years spent on a prison camp in Singapore. His first book, King Rat, is a loosely fictionalized account. Great writer and screenwriter. Besides all the great Asia-focused books he wrote, he also wrote The Fly, the Vincent Price version,
yep.
The Great Escape, To Sir with Love, and a few other movies that look interesting but I've never had a chance to see, about U.S.-Chinese immigrants and Japanese internment camp victims. Incredibly talented writer with a great range. That's interesting. Did you know about this big range, David?
Yes, we talked a little bit about it in the opening episode.
Well, that was a long time ago.
I was really surprised that he wrote To Sir With Love. I had no idea that that's something that would have been in his range to write. But yeah, really, really fascinating guy with a really rich history and going from being a prisoner of war to being a very successful television writer is quite the swing. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And big books too. Like, you know, you talk about George R. R. Martin in the Song of Ice and Fire. Clavell was doing this back in the 80s and he was dropping these heavy, heavy books. Well-researched, you know, incredibly detailed. I mean, he may have had his point of view wrong and some, stitching some things together for plot reasons that are historically inaccurate, but there's a lot of historical accuracy in all of his books. So,
cool.
Yep.
Well, thanks for writing in. Of course, if you, listener, want to write in, you can write into shogun@thelorehounds.com. You could go to thelorehounds.com, head to the contact page, send us a voicemail. We love the voicemails. Or just a contact form entry. You can go to our Discord, chat with us. If you want something included, feel free to tag us. We are on the Discord as our names. For now, we've got to close this episode out, David. So tell me what we're doing next.
What are we doing next? Well, we should talk a little bit about our subscribing. If you're interested in supporting the community and getting access to some great benefits like our second breakfast podcast, which is exclusive just for subscribers, where we talk about life, the universe, and everything. Take a lot of listener feedback. You're doing your Silmarillion Letters of Tolkien. What's it called?
Shireside Chats.
Shireside Chats. Say that 10 times fast. As well, we've got the Show Tracker. We haven't talked about the Show Tracker in quite a while. It's using the Notion database stuff again, but a very curated list of television shows throughout the year. And you can actually line them. You can see them in a sort of Gantt chart view. So you can see what's overlapping and when things are starting. And of course, then we've got these show guides that we're putting together. We did one for True Detective and now for Shogun. For Fallout, we've got one already set up. Aaron Kay has already set up a big one of those. And so that is just it adds a lot of richness and extra contextual information to stuff. And as people find things, we've got a place we can put them and share them. So very cool. And again, subscribers, you know, you're not just supporting John and I. This is actually about our co-hosts and all of the community spaces and the tools that we use. So it'd be great if you are so inclined to join us on Supercast or Patreon.
Cool. Of course, you can join our Discord server if you want to get in on the conversation without being a subscriber, or if you want to be a subscriber. Everybody's in there.
Everybody's there.
And we have a great time. We have a lot of great conversation. We pulled from it tonight, so you got a little taste.
That's right.
We've got our affiliates.
Yes.
Rings and Rituals just started up. That's Marilyn R. Pukila, our favorite Tolkien scholar, doing another Tolkien pod if you didn't have enough yet. She is covering the first season of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power with Dr. Sarah Brown, and they are going through with the lens of ritual. I was actually just on an interview on that podcast. It's out yet, but it will be out. So make sure you subscribe to that feed if you want to hear Marilyn's takes. They're very good. I've listened to episode one so far, and it's really great. Wool Shift Dust is coming back, huh?
Yeah, I'm... Alicia's got some stuff cooking. She's got some Star Wars stuff that she's about to break out. So stay tuned for that. And I know she's got some things in the Dune pipeline. We'll talk about Dune here in just a second as well. So she's cooking. She's cooking. Get ready because she's going to drop some tasty meals on our ears. I don't know. You can't. I'm mixing my metaphors horribly.
Too many metaphors.
Moving on.
You're mixing your natto. And
yeah, don't mix your natto.
So Properly Howard Movie Review is our other affiliate, and Anthony and Steve are on a little break, but I know Anthony's going to be back with you soon to talk about Dune. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was just going to say about Properly Howard too. They have the concept for the next season, but they're putting the season together. And then when they're ready to go, they'll let us know. And of course we're going to do Severance with them as soon as we know whenever Severance is going to come back. But yeah, swinging back around to Lorehounds content, we are going to be recording a podcast for Dune Part 2, and it's going to be Alicia, Anthony, and our friend Ron Dawson joining in as well. And we're going to go in for a kind of a free-ranging wide discussion, one that doesn't have a lot of structure. I just sort of wanted to bring the gang together and see what kind of conversations trouble we can get into. I am literally just back from seeing it for a second time. And I'm really excited to talk about Dune 2. So we're recording that relative to when we're recording this tomorrow. And then as soon as I can get that edited and out the door, probably at some point over the weekend, that'll be out.
Cool. Other stuff we've got going on. I know we have to get scheduled our New Hope podcast so we can get back on our Star Wars train. We are doing...
You guys are doing Halo, right?
We're doing a Halo episode. It's happening. Okay. It's on the docket. We just... Okay. I know Brandon is sick right now. And okay. Brandon's got like pneumonia or something. He's not feeling well.
Okay.
So we will have that scheduled as soon as...
And you're doing Brandon's that with Jean, right? As well.
Jean is going to be there. We're going to talk... So we're going to talk mostly the games. And I think Jean is going to pitch us season two of Halo.
Okay.
That's going to be the deal with that. That'll be fun. Sounds good. Started Avatar The Last Airbender. I'm not talking about it on air.
Okay. All right.
I'm just not going to talk about it. Maybe on Second Breakfast.
All right. Yeah, that would be a good place for it. Second Breakfast. Yeah.
Earthsea is coming. I know you were sick, David. We got pushed back a little bit, but that'll be coming soon. We got to record a Silmarillion story. That'll be coming.
We've got Masters of the Air bookend as well. So we're going to wrap that season up as well because that just ended. Cool. Yeah.
And of course, you just did Oscars coverage with Alicia.
Yes, we did. We did four podcasts about the Oscars, and that was a lot of fun. And thanks for Jean for filling in for me on one of those. And I'm really excited for next year because I think we're going to basically do similar to what we did this year, but more planned out. Like we're going to plan our moves out a little bit more. But we had a lot of fun. We brought in a lot of different community voices. Folks from our Discord, Shane and Adrian and Danny and a number of other people and Alicia. We talked to Marilyn and we talked to some people that Alicia knows about films and stuff. It was a lot of fun. It was a very cool project, and I think it's going to be a big part of what we do next year as well.
Cool. All right, one more thing: our Patreon lore masters.
Yes,
they are Samartian, Mark H, Michael G, Michelle E, David W, Brian P, Nick W, SC, Peter OH, Bettina W, Adam S, Nancy M, Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Eric F, Matthew M, Sarah M, DJ Miwa, Andra B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Aaron T, Sub Zero, Aaron K, Dally V21, Gnarls, and Adrian, who will be last on the list until the day we stop making podcasts.
We're no more. Yeah.
David, it's been a blast.
Thank you so much. Thanks again for Alicia for the coverage. We might have to have her back for season wraps. She seems to be enjoying this season a lot as well. So
yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
See you next week. The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.